Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
All right, tonight we're going to pick up with chapters 8 and 9. That was our reading assignment, I hope, that Dave gave you last week. I don't know what Dave told you last week, but he's off slaving for 2 weeks. In Hawaii, so he may have mentioned a guest teacher. We've got to stand in for the next couple of weeks to help me out and get me through. So our guest teacher won't call me Pawpaw, okay? Yeah. Now, he will call me Dad. For those of you that don't know, this is J.R. Bobo. He's my youngest son, so he worships over in Athens right now, and visits here often and agreed to help fill in some tonight. So let's open our Bibles. We're going to do a quick review and set that context that we keep talking about as to what we've covered in the first few lessons. In lesson one, remember we introduced this talking about Matthew the man, Levi the tax collector, and the fact that Matthew, being chosen the way he was from his profession, had really two of the most radical life changes of any of them, in the fact that, you know, he became an outcast when he became a tax collector, and then when he was selected, that gave him interesting perspective and challenges along with that in his ministry. We also talked a lot about context and perspective. And we want to really focus on that. Much of Matthew, I would guess everyone in here has studied multiple times. We want to especially focus on context and perspective and what Matthew's key audience was and the tools he used, that being a lot of prophecy and fulfillment in convincing those, that Jewish audience, that Jesus was indeed the Messiah, the King that came to the new kingdom here. We talked about John the Baptist, that baptism. I think I'm getting into some of my charts for my review now. Yes. Okay. Talked about John the Baptist. We'll give a little more on that. And the Sermon on the Mount is what David, I think, flew through, he said, last week. Y'all covered a lot of ground in a short period of time. Thinking from chapter 4, where we just talked a little bit about prior to the Sermon on the Mount, we saw the genealogy. We see Matthew convincing or trying to prove to the people that Jesus is that Messiah through his genealogy, through his virgin birth, and then his baptism. And then we kind of step to a different route with the Sermon on the Mount. And there Matthew is showing us how he taught with authority. And that was acknowledged multiple times throughout that series of lessons that he taught in chapters 5 through 7. So we know that he was using that genealogy as a qualification, the prophetic qualification of the birth and his infancy, the father's attestation at his baptism, the spiritual qualification through his resistance to temptation, remember that, and his perfect responses for that. And his, we'll call it a theological qualification through his teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, as we shift to chapters 8 and 9, how would somebody very quickly summarize what's in 8 and 9? It's kind of unique. Okay. That's fine. It's really a series of 10 miracles with a couple of other little lessons and demonstrations thrown in there, but It's 10 specific miracles that cover multiple areas that help prove his authority, his deity, not through his words, through his history and birth, but through his deeds. So you see the continuation here of how Matthew's presenting this series of lessons trying to convince folks. We're going to see through these 10 miracles that he has authority over sickness of all types. He has authority over the world and nature. And I want you to be thinking about these because we're not going to have a lot of time to go into a lot of detail on each one of these, but I do want us to read some of them and pull some nuggets out of that. He also has authority and power over the supernatural, even life and death. He demonstrates that authority in these two chapters with these 10 miracles. Now to our context and setting that perspective that we've tried to do with every lesson. Let's think about our lives in 2024 and the medical knowledge and medicine that we have compared to these diseases that we're going to read about back in that time. Disease was rampant, and it was almost like a death sentence when you got something. In fact, we're going to see that fever is referenced. We consider fever a symptom, you know, when we have an infection. It's a sign of something else, and we've learned that through medical knowledge. To them, a fever was usually, you know, an indication of something very serious, and a lot of time they just said they had a fever and they died of a fever. Most of the time, they just had to let it run its course. They did have some remedies that usually didn't work. Think about the pain. They didn't have Tylenol and Advil and all the modern medicines to just give you some relief from what you were suffering. So think about how long the days were and how long the nights were to somebody that was suffering from some of these diseases we're going to read about. Most of the time, they left permanent scars or deformities or left them debilitated and even to death. Something else I want us to notice as we read through these, there's examples where Jesus healed with words. He said it and it happened. He healed by touch and they were healed. And sometimes he didn't see or touch, but there was distance between Jesus and he never saw the person and they were healed. So let's notice some of those. And he even raised from the dead. And another important point, think about the way Jesus healed. There's a significant difference from what we see in 2024. Doctors and medicine help us. We still rely on God's healing hand and our bodies and the wonderful design within them to recover. It's not that way with these examples with Jesus. It was instant. And in many times they use the word instant or right away, that type of thing. Something else I want us to think about in comparison as we read these is the parallels of these examples and how it aligns with the thought of spiritual healing, with what Christ brought to the world for us.
One other note, and just the context thoughts, and also with this butting in comment thing, I don't know if I'm supposed to raise a hand or just go for it. It's weird with a father-son kind of thing. But one other context thought that puts you in the shoes of people who have these diseases. A lot of these diseases, since they didn't have a lot of medical knowledge on what to do, they would quarantine them. They would throw them out of the city. And with that, I mean, like with leprosy, when we see some people who were healed, I mean, it was visible. A lot of the diseases would be visible. And since they would be visible, you'd get thrown out because everybody could see them. And just like a thought to have is, in that day and time, if you were feeling sick, if you were feeling something that you started to go downhill and you were worried that you might have a disease, would you want to fess up and start telling people that I'm feeling bad? I'm kind of curious if a lot of people just suffered through it. But all that being said is just thinking about The people who come up to Jesus, they probably weren't supposed to be there by that law at that time because they were supposed to be thrown out of the city for the diseases they had. And some of them could have been hiding, and they are openly showing themselves to someone who could throw them out of the city. Just something to think about through what we read.
I think it helps us to appreciate these examples when we put our mind in that context. If you have your Bible, let's open to chapter 8, and we're going to read through these quickly and just see what we notice after setting some context with this. So let's start with verse 1, where Jesus cleanses a leper. When he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him, and behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will, be clean." And immediately, there's that term, immediately, his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded you for a proof to them." Thoughts on what you, with the context that we discussed, what do you see there? What jumps out at you on this short example?
Jesus was willing to touch him. He was a leper. He probably hadn't had a lot of human contact in a very long time.
In a very long time, back to what JR was saying, even to the point of not just the danger, but, you know, it, as an outcast, you weren't supposed to touch a leper, or you wound up on the outcast. So that the touch is more than just to accomplish the healing. I think that's very important. Any other thoughts or anything you notice out of that example?
I think the touching was also a sign of compassion.
Absolutely.
That guy had probably not been touched by anybody for a long time, and then to have somebody touch him probably in a tender way, it was just probably healing to his spirit too.
Absolutely.
Actually, it's not until, just in terms of the power to do this, it's not until my lifetime that there were effective treatments for leprosy.
Okay. So it's fairly recent that the medical knowledge and abilities come that you could help somebody with that disease. Any other comments or thoughts?
I think it's interesting they told him not to tell anyone. But Jesus, right, like in verse 1, it says, large crowds followed him. So I don't know if the man with leprosy was, you know, being sneaky, right? Or everyone saw it and Jesus told him to be like that. That's just odd. Why did he tell him to not tell anybody? But there's a lot of witnesses potentially around, right?
Yep. What do you think? This is not the only verse where this situation occurs.
Well, another verse is, you know, right, when he does that, he's not ready to be, his time's not come, right? He's not ready to be exposed, I guess, to some extent. But I don't know. Maybe you could tell me.
I don't have all the answers. But that's another interesting point in this story, though, that Jesus said not to do that. Now, I mean, we can speculate on some. We know the crowds were collecting and following him, as the story says, and we know he's just beginning his ministry and this healing spree right here through these examples. So it may be that he knew he wouldn't be able to do the things he needed to do if crowds just came in on him and everyone wanted to be healed, which we will see that's what happened.
Well, I kind of wonder if it's not, you know, something like that, him going to the priest and showing himself. The priest would probably be really questionable about that and probably say, you know, don't.
That's very good.
Still don't go see anybody, stay out of the crowd, but if he just went up and said, "Yeah, I think I'm healed," they'd go through the thing, and then he can go back to his family immediately so he doesn't get ostracized again.
I think it's
healing a lot of times is not out of, hey, I'm showing you who I am, as much as he has compassion on that person.
Absolutely.
Because the response of the people, once you start giving them stuff, everybody's going to start lining up.
Yeah.
Give me some more food. You just fed all these 5,000 people.
That's right.
Show it to me again.
That's right. And I agree with that. It's obvious through what we read in the New Testament, the compassion is a huge part of it. But do you have something else, Ed? Or?
No.
Okay. The fact that you brought what he told him to do, to go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded, Jesus is still trying not to upset and just violate, you know, the law altogether. So that could be another thing, the touch. You know, he had touched a leper. He didn't need to get thrown out of the city at this point in his ministry. And he didn't want mobs coming on him at that time. So now, what do we know from Mark chapter 1? He tells the kind of the sequel, finishes up the story. Did that guy go off quietly, go to his home and tell his family? No. He went telling everyone. So, and we read that type of example over and over through Scripture. All right, JR, you want to read the next segment here, which is not so much. Let's read it. Go ahead and read it, unless I've got the points up here, so y'all are cheating if you're reading it here.
The whole thing, 5 through 13?
Yes, yeah. 5 through 13 is what we're going to read.
When he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment.
Okay, thoughts on that one? What jumps out at you? So this is that new type of, wasn't a touch. We get off into now. There was some distance. And we didn't touch on a key piece of the first one that we're going to see in this one, and that being the faith that's there and demonstrated and obvious. So Jesus has compassion, and he also sees the faith in these people that are coming to him.
I think it's the first time we see that Jesus is for everybody. Because he's healing the Gentiles.
I think that's
not just for the Israelites.
I think that's key.
I think it's a wake-up call for his disciples, because I'm sure they're there with him, right? And he's bragging on the faith of the Gentile, right when they're there, and other people that, you know, they're around, they're Israelites. I think it's a wake-up call.
I think that's very interesting, and we'll read some examples of where he was right the opposite toward his disciples, not saying, you have impressive faith, was he? But we'll get to that one.
It just struck me that he didn't even ask for the man to be healed. He didn't ask for anything. He just said, "My servant is lying paralyzed at home, tormented," and Jesus said, "I'll come and heal him."
Yeah.
One of the things that we miss is that if you look at Genesis, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." It was kind of like that. And we imagine the size of the universe, and it all came into being immediately and suddenly. So, but people felt that Jesus had to get real close to somebody to touch him, and this guy had the faith,
yeah,
and the knowledge that he can do anything from anywhere to anybody. I mean, time and distance was not a problem for Jesus.
That's a tremendous faith, is it not? I mean, to exhibit at this point in Jesus' ministry, somebody who, and think about that Gentile perspective and their mindset toward Jesus as compared to the Jewish mindset. And I'm speculating here and adding Robert context, but just putting myself in those shoes as somebody that it almost seems like the Jewish folks, I mean, they were waiting for this Messiah to come. They knew, and they had their copy of the Old Testament and studied it and knew what to expect, but it was almost like they wanted to test him every step of the way and challenge, because it wasn't really the type of king they imagined coming. But the Gentile has a different perspective. And I think about that in today's environment and the people that we encounter. And as you share the gospel with others, I think you'll start to see differences when you sit down to share with someone who's grown up in a denomination, and the questions and the responses you get compared to someone maybe who is completely doesn't know God. So I thought that was an interesting perspective of the fact that he healed a Gentile that had incredible faith.
One other thing with this story too that I think is interesting is, like, the centurion had power. He had servants. And number one, he was doing this for a servant, not a child, not a relative, but one of his servants, which shows some character towards him. But also he talks about, I can tell people to go and they go. And he's pointing to the power of Christ, to Jesus, and basically saying, like, I have power and you're not equals, but he's coming from a humble perspective and basically saying, you are a man of power and I can see that. And that's coming from a place of a man who is an official. So I think that's a kind of a faith perspective on his part too.
Absolutely. And what about that last part, the part about the sons of the kingdom? What verse is that in? Verse 12, backing up, saying, I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Notice every time we see that in the book of Matthew, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. What are we talking about there? Is that a little bit strange to throw into this story after he's referenced some key characters from the Old Testament? What might he be referring to?
I think he's talking that the sons, the Israelites, are going to be left out, while those that aren't of that heritage are going to be welcome.
Or maybe those that he's encountering now of the Jewish faith that reject him, there are going to be people from Israel who are going to be cast out. So interesting that he included it here in this series.
The Israel in the New Testament is the church. Go back and read Romans 9, 10, and 11. Paul spends a good deal of time talking about how the Jews rejected Jesus, and the Christians now are Israel.
Right. Right. And I like the way you said it then. The Christians are the church and the Israel now. Not that the old Israel is now the church, but the other way around. Any other comments on that one? Let's go ahead and catch another one. If not, you want to read the next one too, JR?
Yeah. I'll go ahead and read it. And when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. That evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases.
Okay, the mother-in-law story. Does anything specific jump out at folks in this story that makes you question or pause or makes you say, well, I just captured some observations. And speak up or raise your hand. Don't let me talk over you. But this does tell us that Peter was married. I mean, we can deduce that from the mother-in-law comment. And back to what we said earlier, that fever in a lot of cases was viewed as the disease. And when people got a fever, they often didn't know that was a symptom or an indicator of some other problem. They might not have known what the real problem was. It's specific that Jesus touched her hand. So he touched her when he healed her, but that it was noted that he touched her hand. Just to me gives evidence that there's specificity there. What about the fact that, you know, we talked about the healing progressing to different communities, and now he heals a woman. Any significance to that and having the mindset and perspective of the Jewish community at that time? Again, it was on the spot and complete healing. It wasn't gradual. It wasn't partial. And the demon possessed and all who were sick. And he didn't really mention the specific illnesses, but one of the takeaways to me was that there is no limit, but there were a lot that were being healed for various illnesses. And there is Old Testament prophecy covered here with this example. And also it brings we talked about the natural side of healing a body. Here we see his power and authority over the supernatural. Any comments or questions there?
I've got one. sorry.
Go ahead. But, we'll get through what we get through.
Well, I'll make it quick. I really like, so all of these are just rapid healings. It just keeps on going. And so it gets really monotonous when you just keep on reading them because they all sound the same. But the fact it happens in two verses, it's kind of nonchalant thrown in there that he goes to one of his disciples' houses with him or goes with him to heal someone that he cares about. And I think it just speaks to the character of Jesus, number one, of he was there for, I mean, we already see he was there for Gentiles. He was there for lepers who were unclean, who were cast out. And he was there for his disciples when they needed him. He was all over the place for everybody who had faith and who basically called upon him. And number two, it's such a short and sweet story about like how we are saved or how we help other people become clean. Just the Christian walk is, I mean, how many of us found God by ourselves? Just picked up the Bible one day and read it. I mean, most of the time it's someone who brought Christ to us and they called upon Christ or basically brought Christ to us and Christ reached down and grabbed our hand and we started to follow them after we were healed from our sins. It's just a very short and sweet story that's thrown in there that has some sweet notes where it's he grabbed the hand of someone who was sick and just healed. And she followed him.
Back to that perspective to think about as you read these. It's real easy to read chapter 8 and 9 in 5 minutes, and you've heard it 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. But let's look closer at some of these things. And I think what we're going to do, there are segments of chapter 8 and 9 which are not about healings. I think we're going to drop back and catch those next week along with chapter 10. So let's move on to another miracle in verses 23 through 27. And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O ye of little faith?" Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. And the men marveled, saying, "What sort of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Thoughts?
I think it's kind of funny that Jesus rebukes them.
He what?
He rebukes them, right? So he's saying they have a little faith, but they came to him. Right? It was kind of funny.
Right. Well, they came to him, and they were fearful. I mean, they were thinking they were going
to. But still, they, in their time of need, they did, come to him. Right?
Yeah. I don't know that that is what they expected, the outcome that they were thinking was going to come, but.
I was going to say, when you think about chapter 8, it's like set up. Because it's like he's healing. He heals, a Jew that's disease. He heals a Gentile. Heals another Jewish woman. And then he heals all these people who have demons and various illnesses and stuff. It's like, okay, man. Like, he's healed all these people. And then all of a sudden, one little thing, like a storm pops up. And suddenly it's the disciples are like, oh, yeah. We're going to die. And so you kind of get that, feeling of like, you can see why Jesus might be frustrated with his friends there.
Absolutely.
Because they've just been around him doing all these healings, and he just wants to get a little bit of rest, and they kind of just lose faith for a second. Not saying that, if I had been on the boat, I would have done the same thing. But you can see from Jesus' perspective why he might have been frustrated.
I think that's a good observation from an application perspective to us. I mean, we see a lot of good here at this family at Madison. There's so much good, so much blessing here, but yet we don't have to get very far out of the building and out into the world sometimes to be focused on that car that just cut us off, or, my headache, my pain, instead of thinking about what God has done for me and this family. Is that what you were? Do you have a thought there?
I did, but it kind of veers us off a little bit. That wasn't the same one, but it's like the section we just skipped over, and we're going to come back to. Jesus talks about how he doesn't have a place to lie his head, and then it rolls straight into this scene where he doesn't have a pillow, but he's asleep in the bottom of the boat. So it's just kind of a funny coincidence because he finally found a place to rest, and then his apostles or disciples are bothering him. So.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Verse 27 kind of always catches my eye when I read this. And the guys are talking, and he says, "What kind of man is this?" Kind of like, here's a guy that's healing people immediately. He's doing a lot of miracles that nobody can do, and they're still calling him a man.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's gotten into their head that this is God in the form of a man. You're not dealing with just any other Joe, but this is the Son of God. This person has the Spirit of God in him. He is God. And I don't think they finally realized, even though he's done these miracles time and time again, and how he's taught and all this kind of stuff, I don't think it's sunk in yet that who he really was, at least emotionally. They may be able to intellectually say, yeah, he says he's the Son of God, but I don't think it sunk in as to total power and love
right.
that he has.
I think you're absolutely right. And it makes me think back to context again. We talk about the transition and the fact that there's subtle differences in each one of these miracles. Mm-hmm. And is there purpose to that? So now somebody that can heal any disease, it looks as if, can now control nature.
This was years ago, and I don't know how accurate it was, but some scientist was talking about when you're watching a thunderstorm roll by. I've read where some guys have estimated that a average thunderstorm that within 30 minutes will generate the same amount of power of about 5 or 6 atomic bombs going off. And you imagine here Christ just telling the storm to stop. And so kind of seeing the power that he has to stop 5 or 6 atomic bombs.
Absolutely.
He has the power to stop that kind of display of power.
I think we can all appreciate that. There's probably not a person in this room who hasn't been in a storm that they weren't afraid. All right, let's catch one more, at least.
Can I make one more comment?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I feel like I just keep on holding this up. So I'm a big fan of parallels, and Matthew is full of them. And one that I was reading about in a book, it parallels this story with Jonah. I just cut this one little excerpt out where it says, the contrast between Jesus asleep in the storm and Jonah asleep in another is notable. Jonah's conscience was dead through sin and rebellion. Jesus's conscience was calm through innocence. Jonah was the source of danger on his vessel, and Christ was the source of safety on his. The apostles turning to Christ in this extremity is exactly what they should have done, but the lack of faith that prompted it is deplorable and was rebuked by the master. But just some interesting parallels. And one other note. I think it's notable for Christ being on this boat that he was at peace. And we see throughout this chapter that he finds rest and until he has to save his people. It's just another parallel of Christ can find rest in his ministry at points that we see, and just thinking about Christ being in heaven, finding rest until he gets up and does something about it. And he even had rest through this whole series, but when he had rest in heaven, he still came down to earth to save us. And it's just that action-based where he removes rest only when it's for the sake of his people and saving them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I take away the sacrifice, that spirit of sacrifice and not tiring and growing weary from doing good. Mm. All right, let's finish up chapter 8. We'll have at least gotten through half of the material and pick a couple of nuggets out of that. So this is where he heals the men with the demons, the two men. It's I've always been amazed at this story and remember it from when I was a kid, even to the point of there's a place where I grew up and the guy raised pigs and there was a hill with a pond at the bottom and it's right off the interstate. And every time I drive by it to this day, that's the first thing I think about when I see that hill. But let's read the story. And when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs, so fierce that no one could pass that way. And behold, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Those two sentences I want us to remember. Now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. The herdsmen fled, and going into the city, they told everything, especially what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. What jumps out at you? Story we've heard many, many times. To me, it's important, just that those two sentences. What have you done? What have you to do with us, O Son of God? That's a very clear statement that these demons know very well who that is. And they know what he's there for. But they ask, "Have you come to torment us before the time?" What does that mean? Kenny? It's not time, but they knew a time was coming. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They knew who he was. They knew he was there at the moment, and they are expecting a judgment that results in torment. I mean, that should open their eyes then and open our eyes and increase our faith today, in my opinion. Any thoughts?
One thought that I had on this was that it kind of shows the limitation of demons' power. And it gives us a glimpse into that. Is they asked to be cast out into pigs. They couldn't do it themselves. They couldn't jump to other people. It just kind of shows more of a limitation into what they are, which I thought was interesting.
And obvious to me, there's tons of whys in this WHY in this story. I don't have the answers, but why ask to be cast into pigs? Does that make sense to anybody? And when it happened, why did the pigs run down and drown themselves? I don't know. What happened to the demons after the pigs drowned? That is a trick question. I don't know the answer. I don't know that any of us do, but it's a... Larry?
This could be homework for next week. Melissa was wondering why in Matthew it mentions two men coming out with demons, and in Mark and Luke, they both mention one man.
The leeching.
Mark 5 and Luke 8.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's taking that assignment? All right. That's something we should look into, though, and be able to explain. We've talked about several examples in this class where things are not in conflict and contradictory. Rather, they support one another, and there's reasonable explanations. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Hope to see you next week. Have a good week.